Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Special greetings tonight to military veterans and active-duty military personnel on this eve of Memorial Day, our most thoughtful national holiday. Those of you who have tomorrow off can, of course, stay up late with us tonight to hear from two very bright guests with fascinating stories to tell. Coming up in the second half of tonight's program, a name familiar to Coast listeners, Bill Burns, author, publisher, and TV host. You most likely know him from the TV series UFO Hunters. He has a new book out about that series, and we'll touch on that tonight. But the primary subject with Bill is going to be his other new book, Dr. Feelgood, a shocking story about a physician who administered injections to the rich and famous and powerful, including movie stars, recording artists, and politicians, injections that helped rejuvenate them, gave them energy, cured their ills. But instead of the concoction being vitamins and minerals and blood serum as claimed by the doctor, the miracle ingredient in these injections was methamphetamine. And when you hear the list of patients who quietly got hooked on this stuff, it'll floor you. JFK was a frequent patient. Marilyn Monroe, Mickey Mantle, a list of movie stars as long as your arm. And the consequences for them and for our country were dramatic. Bill Burns joins me in a couple of hours to join and tell us about this sordid tale of Dr. Feelgood. First up, though, is one of the most interesting people I have ever interviewed or known. 1982, I think, was the first time I interviewed Oscar Goodman. Back then, he was known as one of the sharpest defense lawyers in the country, most notably because of his infamous clientele, some of the biggest, most notorious mobsters in the country. Perhaps only in Las Vegas could a guy perceived as a mob lawyer, and some even thought he was part of the mob himself, enter politics and become, in all likelihood, the most popular mayor our town has ever seen. But his story is not merely a Las Vegas story. Oscar Goodman transformed himself into a national figure as well. And if you think Las Vegas itself as a city is outrageous, you're about to meet a guy who pretty much personifies everything about our town. The self-proclaimed happiest mayor in the universe, now the former mayor, and a roving ambassador for Las Vegas, but whose outspokenness and candor make him different from almost any politician you've ever heard, certainly any that I've ever interviewed. Being Oscar is the title of his new tell-all book. And Mayor Goodman is my first guest tonight. I'm more than confident you're going to be captivated by his amazing story. Webmaster Tim Banal and I have put together our usual assortment of tidbits and essays for tonight's Knapp's News section on the Coast to Coast website, including a news report I put together about Oscar Goodman and his colorful clientele. If you want to sort of put some images together with the names that we're going to be discussing tonight. Also, a pair of articles about the worldwide effort to focus attention on the activities of Monsanto, the permanence of the war on terror and what that means for all of us, and a few other items that we will get to tonight if we have time. Good food for thought. We'll have plenty to cover tonight, so time for our first break. And when we come back, the irrepressible Oscar Goodman. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. I don't know who the mayor is in your hometown. I mean, that's some of the names I might know, but I can say with considerable confidence that whoever your mayor is, they're a lot less interesting than Oscar Goodman. Las Vegas, of course, is a place where a lot of people come for a new start or a second chance. It is bawdy and bright and bodacious and non-apologetic. And in that sense, Oscar Goodman was a perfect fit to become our mayor. He's always been something of a showman. He admits that he likes to drink now and then. He's ready to gamble on pretty much anything that moves. He's often photographed in the company of statuesque showgirls. And he came to prominence by defending some of the most notorious men in modern American history, mobsters. If you've ever seen the Martin Scorsese film Casino, not only does Oscar Goodman appear as himself in the movie, But the main characters in that movie are based on real-life clients of his. Yet despite his colorful associations and clientele, he was elected three times as our mayor, still had an 80% approval rating when he left office, and if not for term limits, would still be our mayor. His wife succeeded him, the only time in a major American city in history that's happened. Probably could have been elected governor if he wanted the job, and is basically a brand name. In Nevada, he's like Elvis or Cher, one of those stars that only need one name, Oscar. His new book, Being Oscar, describes in his words this amazing ride so far. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the show.
Outrageous and irrepressible? That is unbelievable, George. How do you say that? It's so, you know, for me, this is very late at night. I've already had an entire bottle of Bombay Sapphire, and I lost my first basketball game this evening, so I'm ready for it.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm telling the audience they're going to enjoy this ride here. You know,
I'll tell you something. I never heard a fella use such big words on the radio. It's unbelievable. I'm not even sure what irrepressible means.
People here in Las Vegas, of course, know you so well, but some in the Coast audience probably don't know that much about you. So I want to start with the part of your story that is most familiar to them, namely the mob stuff. The mafia, the outfit, some of the guys you represented. Tell us about how you first came to defend the so-called wise guys. And I was surprised to learn from the book you started with the name that many consider to be the most important and influential mobster in history, Meyer Lansky.
Well, that came down the pike. What happened originally is we came out here, arrived here in 1964 in Las Vegas, and had $87 between my wife and myself. And my dad gave us a wonderful wedding gift, $25 a week, and the money had to be spent for enjoyment. It couldn't be spent for necessities like rent or gasoline. And I would take Carolyn to the Hacienda, which is now imploded. It's where the Mandalay Bay, I believe, presently exists. And we'd have a nice dinner, and then after dinner, she would sit down at the blackjack table. And believe it or not, she was a counter before they even knew what counters were. When she was a youngster, she and her folks used to play a game called Concentration, where they take 52 cards and spread it out on the floor and then try to match up a king to a king, a seven to a seven, etc. And she was able to win a little bit of money. And Las Vegas was different in those days. I would stand behind her and talk to the dealer. I didn't want them to think I was a sucker, because I knew that, you know, they didn't build these beautiful places because people were beating them. And the dealer and myself became very friendly. And a couple of weeks went by, and he called me up and he said that he wanted to file a bankruptcy petition. And I said, come on down to the office. I had a little office on top of a flower shop in downtown Las Vegas, and it was very romantic. The roses used to waft up through the floor into my office, and we sat down and we wrote out the bankruptcy petition by hand. And he was happy. I was happy. And a couple weeks later, a phone call came into the pit of the Hacienda. And the fellow who called was a mobster from the Northeast United States, whose brother had been arrested in Las Vegas for a dire act, which was transporting a stolen car across state lines. And he wanted to know who the best criminal lawyer was in Las Vegas. And the pit boss cupped the phone. He couldn't say that he didn't know. No one ever says they don't know in Las Vegas. Everybody knows everything. And he says, who's the best criminal lawyer in Las Vegas? And the fellow who was the car dealer said, call Oscar. And that's how it started. A gravelly voice in the other end of the line called me and said, come on over to a very affluent part of the community. And I was scared to death. I was a young baby lawyer. And I said to Carolyn, my wife, I said, you want to take a ride? And we drove over to this place and went to the front door. And the fella came to the door and he said, here's three dimes and you better win the case. I had no idea what he was talking about. He handed me an envelope, went around the corner, opened up the envelope. I saw $3,100 bills. I had never seen that much money in my entire life. And the next day, the brother calls and he says, you better win this case. And I tried the case in the old federal courthouse here, which is now the Mob Museum, and got very, very lucky. I think the jury felt sorry for me. I think I could try the case 100 times. I'd lose at 99. This time I won it. And from that point on, whenever anybody asked the mobster from the Northeast who the best lawyer was in Las Vegas, I got the call. And the case that put me into prominence was the first wiretap case under the Omnibus Crime Bill, which was passed in 1964, a wiretap took place of some bookmakers down in Miami. The phones at the Miami International Airport were tapped, and a fellow who was providing the line information or the sports wagering information to the folks in Miami was a bartender at the Golden Nugget, and the defendants heard about me, and they called me and said, would I represent him? And I went down there, and once again, I was very, very lucky because my client, after 3 weeks of trial, was severed out, and everybody else was found guilty, and they never tried my client again. So everybody said Oscar won the first wiretap case in the United States, and then the lawyer who represented Meyer Lansky down in Miami gave me a call, and he said, would you represent Mr. Lansky in Las Vegas, who was charged with a skim at the Old Flamingo Hotel? And I said, you bet I would. And he wrote me a big, fat check. And everybody in that case was found guilty except my client. Fortunately, I had doctor's reports that said he was too ill to go to trial. And the government attorneys, they were pulling their hair out. The FBI was going nuts. They took pictures of Lansky walking his little poodle down at 21st and Collins in Miami Beach. While the others are being found guilty, he's out there because he's too sick to go to trial in Las Vegas. And finally, the judge in Las Vegas threw that case out. And from that point on, I was the mob's lawyer.
I know for years later, even to me and other reporters here in town, when you were asked about what's the deal with the mafia, and you would say, what mafia?
I said that because I was a true American and believed at that time in the integrity of the FBI. And that's what J. Edgar Hoover said. So what was wrong with repeating him?
At what point did you learn who Meyer Lansky was and what role he had played in building modern Las Vegas, what role he still had, what role he was in the mafia, that it really did exist?
You know, basically, I really didn't know the depth of the mob's involvement in Las Vegas until I saw the movie Casino. when I saw that, I said, my goodness, had I known what I was doing all those years, I would have charged a lot more and probably have my own private plane. But basically, when the wiretaps unraveled and I had an opportunity to hear them, that's when I found out who I was representing. I really had no idea. I thought they were just hidden owners of the hotels. And it wasn't until I listened to the wiretaps in their cases that I found out that because of their greed, they put an end to themselves, basically, because they would skim $25,000 a month and then send it back to the various crime families. Since Las Vegas was what was called an open city, there was no mafia family here in Las Vegas, and they chopped up this money, and basically their greed ended their power here.
You heard at one point some sort of a discussion of an oath, right? Or something on tape?
Yes. You know, I used to make fun during the trials when the informants would get on the witness stand and they were turning on their colleagues, and they would talk about a mafia induction ceremony. And, you know, it sounded as so fictional to me. They would talk about putting a gun on the table, taking a knife out, pricking a finger, having a drop of blood, a fall on a card with a picture of a saint on it, taking that card and burning it, taking this oath that if, in fact, your brother was a rat, an informant, would you kill him? Yes, I would, and those kind of things. And I thought it was a joke, to be honest with you. I really believe that these people were making that up, and it was something out of The Godfather. And then when I was representing a gentleman by the name of Vinny Ferrara up in Boston, the prosecutor called me and he said, Oscar, we have a tape of a mafia induction ceremony. We entered a home surreptitiously and recorded the ceremony, and your client's on the tape, and now you won't be able to make fun of the witnesses when they testify that there's a mafia. And I said, you got to be kidding. And I listened to the tape, and the tape was a remarkable tape. They talked about a gun on the table and taking a knife out and pricking a finger and getting a drop of blood on a card with a picture of a saint on it and burning the card and saying that if your brother were to testify against you, would you kill him, and so forth and so on. And I was representing this fellow on a very serious case involving several murders and racketeering and extortion and all types of crime. And the judge said, if you're going to resolve the case, resolve it now or else we're going to go to trial. And I sat down with my client and a co-defendant, and I said to him, you know, fellas, I could really win this case. I really believe I could beat the murder case. I could beat the extortion. I could beat the robbery. I could win this case. And I really don't have a problem as far as the induction ceremony is concerned, the part about, you know, killing your brother if he's a rat. That's a Judeo-Christian. That goes back to Cain and Abel. No problem with that. I said, but guys, I said, this part about leaving your mother on her deathbed if the boss summons you, I said, I don't think I could overcome that. So Vinny turns to his colleague and he says, JR, next time we'll leave that line out.
You note in the book, Being Oscar, you say that you never asked your clients if they did the crime. You didn't really want to know. You were going to defend them. And I'll divert a moment from the list of clientele. We'll come back to it. But in court, and in interviews you would give, you'd always refer to the Bill of Rights. You would uphold the Constitution. You would hold the government to this high standard. You'd go after them on things like wiretaps. Your thoughts now on the emergence of the surveillance state, where our country is headed, the almost willing surrender of individual liberties by members of the general public.
You know, it's such a shame, really. And I think basically the surrender began on 9/11. I mean, here are 19 guys who changed the way we think of freedom and how we do our business in this country. Prior to that time, I felt that, you know, we could come and go without fear of anything taking place. And now you go to an airport and the searches are maybe necessary. I don't know whether they're necessary anymore. They're very intrusive. It's as though people's philosophies and mentality has changed, that they accept Big Brother coming into their life. They say, well, it's okay if they listen to phone calls because we're not doing anything wrong. We're not saying anything wrong. And if they get the bad guys, it's worthwhile. I'm not sure that the sacrifice was really worth it. It was nice to be free, feel as though we can say and do things that we felt we could do without going over the cusp or violating the law. But now we've almost given an open invitation and welcome the intrusive ear of Big Brother into our lives. And to me, that's very offensive.
You had to deal with wiretap evidence in some of those early and famous cases. Today, you know, you don't know who's listening. I mean, there's warrantless wiretaps, and then you've got all kinds of flying drones that can kill you in the sky. You've got incarceration of people without charging them.
It's a terrible thing, in my opinion. I understand where it all started, and the Gitmo with the prisoners there. We are fearful of them. We believe that they're part of a group that is trying to harm our country. But, you know, it is the United States of America. The Bill of Rights is what distinguishes us, I believe, from every other country. We preserve through those Bill of Rights our basic liberties. People have fought and died to uphold those. And when they get softened and don't have to be followed, when the courts make a decision that the ends justify the means, in effect, to me, that's the beginning of the end of the freedoms that we enjoy in this country. And I try to protect against that. I really do. And I'm fearful that what's taking place today with the folks back in D.C. Just feeling that they don't have to be accountable, that they can invade our privacy through the Patriot Act with very little probable cause. That is a very dangerous sign for this country.
I think back in the day, some of the trials I remember sitting in on, when you would start talking about Bill of Rights, Constitution, that I could see the prosecutors roll their eyes as if it was a routine. I just wanted to bring it up now because it wasn't just a routine for you.
No, it wasn't.
I mean,
you know, and people used to say that Oscar won the case on a technicality. Well, the technicality was the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. In the book, Being Oscar, my favorite chapter is one that really has nothing to do with the mob. It involves a black gentleman that I represented who was a known heroin dealer to law enforcement, and they were after him, and they got information that he was going to meet somebody in a drug deal down in Texarkana, and the person who was meeting him was flying in from San Diego. And
Mayor Goodman, I'm going to have to interrupt you for a moment. We'll pick up that story after the break. And what other town has a cool song like this as sort of its unofficial theme song? We're talking with Mayor Oscar Goodman, author of Being Oscar, here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us, everyone. Another slice of Las Vegas coming to us from our guest tonight, former Mayor Oscar Goodman, author of the new book, Being Oscar. You know, it's his story told in his words about his legal career and his rise to power in political office. But it also is the story of our city in many ways. The two mirror each other. When we come back, we continue with some colorful accounts of the people he has known and the events that have marked his life. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. My guest, Oscar Goodman, author of Being Oscar, From Mob Lawyer to Mayor of Las Vegas, Only in America. Fascinating new book. Mayor, before the break, you were telling us the story of this heroin dealer.
Yes, a real quick story. There were four redneck cracker cops down in Texarkana who testified about a search and seizure that took place of this alleged heroin dealer. And I invoked the exclusionary rule, which means that the witnesses could not be in the courtroom while another witness testified. So three of the cops sat in the hallway while the first cop testified that he went up to my client's car and said, sir, would you mind if we talk to you? And they indicated my client said, no, not at all. Well, I knew right off the bat there was something wrong because my client would never talk to the police and has never been called sir in his life by a law enforcement officer. And they went on and said, would you mind giving us the key to your car? And he said, no problem at all. Would you mind stepping out? No problem at all. Could we open your trunk? Yes. Would you mind if we open up the bag of the trunk? And he said, go right ahead, according to their testimony. And they found $267,000. And I said, no, this could not be. This can't be the truth. But my client saying, they're lying, Mr. Goodman. I said, Manny, you're a black fella. These are four white cops. There's no way in the world the judge is going to listen to you now. Be quiet. Let me do my thing. Next cop gets on the stand. Same thing, word for word, hand in glove. Next cop gets on the stand. Same thing, under oath. I swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. And then the last one gets up, and Manny says, Mr. Goodman, they're lying. They're lying. And the people in the van know they're lying. I said, what do you mean, Manny? He said, you know that van that picks up the pilot and the flight attendants and takes them to the motel? They had to have seen this. I said, you got to be kidding. I said to the judge, Judge, can I have a timeout? I think I have something very important to bring to the court's attention. And he said, all right, we'll be back here tomorrow morning. We'll give you the afternoon to work out whatever you have to. So I ran back to my law office. I knew that the plane at least had to have stopped in San Diego. I didn't know where it originated from. I knew it was an American Eagle plane, and we tracked it down. And I found out who the pilot was, and I called him, and I said, would you mind coming down and telling the judge exactly what happened that day? He said, that's fine with me. And he came down, he gets under oath, he's on the witness stand, and the judge said, well, tell us what happened. And he says, it was like Miami Vice. He said, they took this guy out of the car, they threw him on the ground, they put a gun to his head, they put cuffs on his back, they were all over him, they took the key out of the ignition, they went to the trunk, they opened it up, they took this bag. And of course, the judge found that the four lying cops were lying, and he granted the motion to suppress under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Now, that wasn't a technicality. That was exposing four liars to the court. And you know what happened? Besides throwing the case out, nothing to them. They perjured themselves, and nothing happened to them. They weren't charged, and they're going to do it to some other citizen who isn't a alleged heroin dealer, who isn't a black fella. They're going to do it to you or to me because they got away with it this time.
You've heard the argument, though. Gosh, Oscar, what you do is you keep bad guys out of prison where they belong.
Well, I'll tell you
that guy,
George, let me tell you something. If the government can't do its job right, if they can't adhere to the Constitution, to the Bill of Rights, and to do their job without engaging in misconduct, They're not entitled to putting anybody away. That's the way our system works. And it better work that way, or else people who really aren't doing anything wrong could be abused by an abusive show of power by those who are in authority. And that's what I did. I rarely put my client on the witness stand. I felt that I could do a much better job in my closing argument than they could under cross-examination. I never asked my clients what they did unless I needed an alibi, and they were able to provide that for me. Other than that, most people don't know what they do. I'll give you a perfect example. God forbid you go home tonight, and I talk about this in the book, Being Oscar. You go home, you see your front door has been jimmied open, you see your drawers are all askew with your clothes all over the floor, your television's missing, you pick up the phone, you call 911, you say, I was what? Everybody will say, I was robbed. You weren't robbed. You were burglarized. And that's because the law is a very technical. It's an art as well as a science. And robbery is taking something by force or threat of force. Burglary is entering with the intent to commit a felony. And the difference really is for the person who's found guilty of it, because it's about a 15-year difference in the penalty. But I really didn't want my clients to tell me they did something because they really didn't know what they did.
You know, you in the movie Casino, the character played by Joe Pesci is based on another client of yours, maybe the client that with whom you are most often identified, Tony Spilotro, Tough
well,
Tony.
I spent a lot of time with Tony. You know, I represented him on murder cases. I represented him on racketeering cases, on black book cases. So I spent a lot of time with Tony, and it was a wonderful opportunity for me as a lawyer to have the best that the government could throw at us. And to be able to prevail. He never spent a day in jail other than being arrested and waiting for me to come back into town from a case that I had out of town before we would make an application for bail. But during all those years, he was never convicted of anything. And it used to really bother me, George, that FBI agents would crow around town that Tony Spilotro killed 22 people. Some said he killed 26 people. And I'm saying to myself, if he killed 26 people, why don't they convict him?
You made a statement at some point that came back and was thrown at you during the mayoral race, I think your first race, that you'd rather have your daughter marry, I forget the exact quote, but rather than marry an FBI agent, you'd rather have him marry somebody in the Spilotro family, something like that?
I said I'd rather have my daughter marry Tony Spilotro than an FBI agent because Tony never lied to me. And it was a rarity that an FBI agent would get on the witness stand under oath and didn't tell a fib. And that's the reason I was a halfway successful lawyer, because I was able to catch them in their lies. And to me, it was intolerable. I was brought up by a very conservative set of parents. My dad was a deputy district attorney in Philadelphia. And we believed in mom and apple pie and the flag. We really did. And when I started to practice, and I saw that these FBI agents in particular made the ends justify the means and would testify with impunity about things that never took place, feeling that my clients were so bad, so evil, so venal, that they must have done something sometime, even if they didn't do it regarding the case in which they were testifying, so it was okay. To me, that was outrageous.
In those days, the 70s, even into the 80s, the FBI agents who were here, IRS agents too, I think, to some extent, looked at everyone in Las Vegas as a mobster or a crook. Everyone was corrupt.
I had a wonderful experience, which really showed me what it was all about. I didn't realize how pervasive it was. About 6-7 months ago, I get a knock on my door on a Sunday afternoon, and there's a lovely young lady there, and she was the daughter of, and this is an oxymoron in many respects, of a Metro intelligence officer. And she said, Mr. Goodman, my dad passed away, but he wanted you to have this book. And it was the intelligence log of the Metropolitan Police Department from 1979 up until 1981, being a catalog of all their surveillance every single day for over an entire year period. They were making notes of surveilling everybody in Las Vegas. I mean, legitimate county commissioners who were good guys. Every suspect, as far as being a mobster, most lawyers who represented them, and I got such a kick out of it because I saw references to myself. It said, Oscar went to the airport. Well, the taxpayer dollar really went a long way for them to make that observation. And then 5 days later, Oscar came home. You know, it was that kind of thing that was so outrageous, but that's what they were doing in those days. They were following everybody in Las Vegas and just making a memorandum of where they saw them and what they were doing. And there were no arrests. There were a lot of pullovers. People would be driving down the road, and they would pull the car over and conduct a search and come up with nothing. But that resulted, if you'll recall, in a very innocent guy who was a hotel employee and who had some relationship with the client that you mentioned, Tony Spilotro, coming home from work. He was going to get a pizza. He's pulled over, and the two cops who pulled him over, they shot him dead. Right on the highway, and they claimed that he was pulling a gun out of his pocket. They never found a gun. He had a set of keys in his hand.
Well, I happened to have been there on that night at that same restaurant an hour before he got there, just by coincidence. And I've often thought about it, that they could have followed me because they didn't know who I was in those days, too.
And that's true. And the same thing could have happened to you, George. And that would have been, as horrible as what happened to this young man. But once again, nothing ever came of it. There was sort of an unwritten rule that these law enforcement people were going after bad people, and therefore they could do whatever they wanted to do, and they weren't going to be punished if they took the wrong path.
You became close to Tony Spilotro because you defended him so many times in so many venues. You were also close to Lefty Rosenthal, Frank Lefty Rosenthal. He's the Robert De Niro character in Casino. And because of that, I think there was an assumption that maybe you were part of the mob. You were the consigliere.
No question. That's what they thought. As a matter of fact, some people actually testified to that in proceedings. And there was a wise guy by the name of Shannon Bybee, who was very well respected here. I don't know why, to be honest with you. He made some wise-ass remark, if I'm allowed to say that on the radio. The definition of organized crime, he said, was anybody that Oscar Goodman represented.
And of course,
is that a responsible statement from somebody who was on the State Gaming Control Board, the agency that was supposed to make sure that gambling was legit? No, I don't think so. And I did not let him get away with it. I went after him, and I was never a good winner, George. I crowed when I won a case, and I wanted to rub the prosecution's face in the mud when I was fortunate enough to get a not guilty or a case thrown out based on misconduct, I hope that made a little bit of difference. I'm not sure it did.
Well, they hated you for it.
Well, that's a good thing. I wasn't looking to be loved. I wanted to be respected and feared. Love was never part of the picture until I became the mayor. Then I really wanted to be loved.
It was important for you to not become part of the people you represented, though. It was important for you and for them, to not being involved.
That's right. And I learned a lesson early on. It wasn't in the book. It'll be in the next book. I don't know how this came about, but when we were flying back from Las Vegas, Carolyn and myself came out to be interviewed for a job and with the DA's office here when I was in law school. And on the plane was a fellow from New York who I don't know whether he was real or he was pretending to us. He seemed to be real, and he said that he'd like to see me in Philadelphia, and could he come down and talk to us? And we didn't have 2 cents. We were living in a little apartment in a neighborhood where the shotguns were heard during the summer months, and Carolyn had to have mace in her pocket before mace was even popular when she came home from work, because that's how dangerous the neighborhood was around the law school in those days. And he would come down, and he'd visit us, and he'd shower us with gifts. He brought me my first suede jacket. It was a big deal in those days. Brought her silverware and a nice cutlery and that kind of thing. And sooner or later, the conversation came to, well, you know, we'd like to offer you a job. And we was never described, but just the way he said it perked our attention. And if you come to work for us, we'll get you a beautiful apartment in Central Park in New York. And I knew which one he was talking about. It's a round building there. And right in Central Park, and you'll do very important work for us, And if you like it, after a year, you'll stay on with us. And you can always get out before the year is up. But after the year is up, you can't. And when he said that, I said to myself, this sounds like something out of The Godfather. And I'm not going to be in anybody's pocket. I don't care what they're offering me. I have to be independent. And from that point on, we knew that we couldn't be bought and paid for. And Carolyn would say to me time and time again, your clients want you to be a cut above them. And I said, what does that mean, sweetheart? She said, they want you to be respected. They want you to have credibility with the judges. They don't want you to be like they are in the eyes of law enforcement. And she was absolutely right. I would have had no value to them if I was like that. And over the years, I've seen too many lawyers become like their clients with the very enticing lifestyle, with the beautiful women, the wine, the song, the whole bit. I was all business and never let that happen, and it inured to my clients' benefit, and that's the way I practiced law for many, many years. It was a lonely life, too, and for a young lawyer, these clients lived a Damon Runyon-esque existence. It was very, very tempting, but thank goodness I had somebody who tempered me.
Was there ever a concern that maybe you knew too much because you'd been in on these meetings,
these
clients?
No, interesting, George. This is the honest to goodness truth. My clients were very sensitive to that. They did not share their lives with me. They didn't share the inner sanctum with me. It was all need to know. What I needed to know is all I knew, and they were very careful in sheltering me. For instance, Tony Spilacho, that we've mentioned before, had an associate by the name of Frank Collada. And Collada makes it sound like he was Spilacho's right-hand man. The truth of the matter is, Tony would say to me, this guy's a jerk. Don't go around him. Don't say anything in front of him. And basically, that's the way I treated Collada. They were very careful to protect me from their life. I was not a consigliere. Nobody asked me whether or not they had permission to kill anybody or to rob anybody or to burglarize anybody. They wanted me to be their lawyer, and therefore I felt very safe, very secure. They took very, very good care of me. They were very nice to my staff. They were very good to my family, but never mixed their business in with my business.
You know, back when the casino skimming operations started to crumble, I mean, they were talking about tens of millions of dollars over a course of several years. When that started to crumble, people started to die all over the place. They were being killed left and right. The mob bosses back east were severing any potential witness. Never any worry that you might be in danger?
No, never at all. The only time I ever found out that I would have been in danger was after the fact. I had read an obituary of a fellow by the name of Frankie the German Schweiz, who was a witness in a case involving the killers of Tony Spilacho. And apparently in his obituary, he was quoted as saying that he was going to kill Tony and Tony's brother Michael and Oscar Goodman, their lawyer, with an Uzi. But I had never had any inkling that was out there.
Well, you know, you think about Spilacho, and we know how things ended. If you saw the movie, that's sort of how it was in real life. And despite all the things that were alleged, that was a bad way to go. That had to have affected you when you heard that news.
It did. It did. As a matter of fact, Nancy Spilacho called me and said that she hadn't heard from Tony. That was very, very unusual. She was very concerned. I heard shortly thereafter, of course, that he was found in this cornfield in Indiana, and apparently he had been buried alive. And I went back to Chicago for his funeral, and it was very interesting because sometimes at a funeral, the people who aren't there are the ones who pique your attention, and there were certain people who weren't there, which I felt were very unusual, people who were very close to Tony. And the fascinating thing about it is because Tony had so many problems, because I was his lawyer and represented him in those problems, I probably spent more time with him than anybody other than his wife. And you would have thought that the FBI would have come to me and asked me whether I had any idea who killed him. Not that I would have told them if I knew, but nevertheless, nobody ever came to me. It's as though they didn't even want to solve that particular murder. And they were just happy to be rid of him. But it was fascinating to me. When Tony was alive, the FBI used to say he was the mob's representative at Las Vegas, that he was the man who had to report back to the mob. And when he died, the same people minimized his involvement and said, oh, he's just a street punk and didn't have any power at all. So just they make up the story in order to serve their own interests.
We're talking with Oscar Goodman, author of the new book, Being Oscar. It's a wonderful and entertaining look at his life and the life of this fabulous city. Our conversation continues, including a look at a case involving a federal judge and actor, indirectly, actor Woody Harrelson. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM.